Do you find that in with the introduction or the advance, or if you do you find with the technological revolution that's happened in the last 30 years, that that's speeded up work in academia?
I was first thinking about lectures, but it has changed the nature of lectures, but we wouldn't call it speeding them up particularly. It's made it much easier for accurate, for students to keep accurate records of what is said in lectures, because you produce slides for them, PowerPoint presentations and handouts and all sorts of things. That's all become much, much easier. So there's no excuse for students not to have a record of what you might have said. But speeding up, the one thing it has speeded up inordinately is the research, because of communication and the way in which people can communicate much more fully and effectively and quickly through emails and sending off things has really altered the nature of research, because it really used to be very difficult to do joint research except with somebody in the same institution. Now people do it all over the world because they can just communicate freely. From my point of view, I've not been actively involved in sort of original research for, well, since I became head of the department basically in 2000, that's now 15 years ago. So I don't know how much things have developed, but I've not been actively participating in the way that things have developed over the last few years. But I'm certainly aware in my own communications with academics that things are much, much more straightforward. But I mean, like until last year, I was chairman of a board of examiners and organising exams, making sure that the scripts are there and have been reviewed and assessed, and that the people know the times of the meetings, and that all the students' results are coordinated and presented. All that has become much, much more straightforward and can therefore be done much more quickly. So I think, yeah, there has been a real alteration. And the other thing is rather that whereas very few academics could type when there were typewriters, with these things they can all type. And that is, I think, not least because the word processors with are much, much more productive.
So would academics, when you first arrived at LSE, would academics write everything out by hand then, and then would like a secretary type it up?
Of course, with more mathematical papers, it's an immensely slow process, because typing out mathematical formulae is fairly difficult.
Especially on a typewriter.
I presume they had special typewriters, I don't know. It's still quite difficult even with ordinary language like Word or WordPerfect. It's not easy to type out complicated mathematical formulae, but there are, of course, special, I'm sure what they're called, programs or something for scientific words and so on, which have got much more features which enable you to do it. And there's still difficulties of people using different languages, whatever they're called. You can't easily convert from one to another. So I found if I wrote an exam paper in Word, because I don't have complicated math formula in my exams, but a colleague wanted to put in some questions, which did, then we had quite a struggle trying to merge them. And in fact, I think the only way to do it was to print them out and scan them or something.
I think looking back on your time here, what have been the main highlights, moments that really stick out in your mind?
I suppose I mean, there are obviously moments in my professional career, like becoming a professor, becoming head of a department, things like that, and in research, in making, having, going to major conferences and making big presentations, which sort of attracted the interest of internationally acclaimed colleagues, academics around the world. You know, I think those things were the main professional. And I said, there's nothing desperately exciting. Don't really know. This, I was sharing an office with at the moment with Charlie Bean, who is a former head of, well, deputy director of the Bank of England, but basically was a professor here quite a long time while I was here. Now he's also a part-time teacher. He's come back to teach some lectures on monetary policy. That's his desk, and this is a cartoons of people in the Bank of England, which he has chosen to adorn his desk with. But it's not mine at all. It's not, nothing to do with me.
Has working with like the professors and academics here been a highlight?
It's been an
intellectual highlight.
Yeah, I think certainly some of them has been very stimulating to work with. So in the economics department, of course, there's lots of academics who are sort of quite famous, and some of whom are quite good as well. my research has been very much, I've worked a great deal with Richard Layard, who is still around a lot. Have you spoken to him?
Yeah, last week.
Yeah, he's a very wonderful person to work with. Yeah, we wrote lots and lots of things together. We had shared very similar views on unemployment and macroeconomics, things like that. I never could share his enthusiasm for the euro, even from the early days. And he wasn't that keen on happiness either. So we haven't been working together as much, but we have this great history of having worked together for the great formative years in the Centre for Labour Economics and Centre for Economic Performance. And that linked also to another thing which has actually been a professional, a major highlight of my career, which has been the college in Moscow, which he founded, which I've been running for the last 15 years, which has brought me into quite a bit of sort of, I don't know, more international sort of activity. And it's you know, so the college in Moscow has sort of done quite well, but we've, like each year, we have a graduation ceremony which has been hosted by the British ambassador to Russia, which is quite a sort of interesting thing to be doing. And so there have been various things of that nature. But yeah, I think you're right. So the colleagues who I have known here have been, by and large, pretty good. Charlie Bean actually is one of the most likeable of them. he's a very, very straight person. He just sort of, he's always completely clear what he says and why, and he somehow has this aura of being completely honest, and somehow manages to be completely honest. It's an extraordinary achievement. I don't know anyone else who manages that. But yes, so there have been quite a lot of people in the school who I very much like.
Have you taken part in any sort of recreational activities while
you've been here? Did you get involved with any clubs or sports? No.
Did you get involved with any sort of staff social activities or networks?
No, not really, no. I mean, there are people that I mean, there's the colleagues who I might meet socially, you know, who have, might have come out to dinner or something like that, but no sort of network, no.
What do you think the future of LSE will look like?
Yeah. mean, the picture I have, of Alice is sort of like perhaps like a rhinoceros or something. It just sort of keeps going, just very thick skin. Things are thrown at it all the time, but just ploughs on. And it's a sufficient identity and self-belief, as it were, that it just goes on, and there's always because its beliefs, although not necessarily mainstream, are important enough. So the ideals of academic rigour and policy relevance in some way being combined together. I think it will continue. The future of the universities as a whole seem to be much more unclear because well, there's obviously too many of them, and they sort of cost too much. The fees are now, I mean, it's not clear that it's worth the students' while to pay such high fees, and the technology is, it's true that most IT-delivered distance learning type stuff doesn't really work because there's no, there's in some way, because it's always there, it can't impose any obligation on the viewer to, or the student to, commit their time to it somehow. You know, the students who paid all this money, or even if they hadn't paid all the money, they'd given up all their time. They've got 3 years of their life to be here. They owe it to themselves to get some payback from having done that. So they have they feel they have an obligation to try and learn anyway. Whereas if you know something that's just on the telly, you don't have any obligation to do anything. It's always there, free and for nothing. So anyway, it doesn't, in any case, whatever reason, the MOOCs don't seem to be a very powerful form of competition. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that it seems extraordinarily inefficient for, you know, hundreds of people all over the world to be teaching some very similar courses. Why not, you know, have a smaller number that you can be plugged into more directly? And we are finding that already, that a lot of the students don't trouble to attend lectures. They're sort of voluntarily undermining the whole principle of university by not turning up. And because they don't turn up, they don't actually get the benefit, much of which comes from talking to other students, not from academics, because there's never enough academics to go around, as it were, to talk to all the students. But by talking to each other, they learn a lot. And but they can't do that if they're not here, and if they, you know, they find the lectures are, you know, not all, but many of the lectures are now recorded, so the students don't need to turn up. They can watch them at home or anywhere else, and they get their lecture notes. There's a sort of already a disintegration. Of an important part of the contribution of university. So I'm unclear. It does seem to me that there's one of the departmental meetings a question about, you know, that student attendance at lectures wasn't very good. What should we do about it? And so he said, well, of course, what's their lectures? So I said, what do we think the importance of lectures is? Why do we give them rather than just tap into some of these MOOCs? And no one had an answer. I mean, the teachers themselves don't know why students should come to their lectures. So it's not surprising that no one else does. So I think there is a worry there. And the University of London has this external programme, which is now basically focused on what they call a virtual learning environment, which is basically things you can access on the internet. and what should we put our lectures on it? You know, then what would the internal students be getting that the external students are? Why should we charge them 9,000 a year and the other one, the external ones, get it for 1,200 or something? Yeah, so there's the message is that I think that there is likely to be a for very good students there will be advantages in keeping universities in their present form, because maths courses are not good enough for very good students, because they're too, you know, they're too basic. They can't possibly be at a sufficiently sophisticated level. But for the sort of bulk of the students, not necessarily at LSE, but in the system as a whole, it just can't be sensible to teach them in 100 colleges all over the country, rather than providing really good standard stuff which could be transmitted through the internet. Even though we don't at present know how to achieve a degree of commitment by the students which means that the education is as effective. Well, it may be you can only do it with people actually being there, but I can't quite see why. Anyway, so my position basically is that I think the future of the universities is very troubling and uncertain, but LSE is well positioned within universities because the focus on good academics and interesting research and generally high quality of academic input, what in the jargon is called research-led teaching, is something that we can do well and something that can't be sort of turned over to the mass market.
So you've kind of answered pretty much most of the questions that I had. Just thinking back over everything that we've talked about, do you feel there's anything that I haven't asked you, anything that you want to say that you haven't been able to talk about yet?
There's one of your questions which you didn't actually ask. How has the campus changed? Why should I? Well, here, I think the extension of the campus has changed the nature of the relationship between the school and the departments. Because we're so spread out. In the old days, nearly everyone was in the old building or buildings around Houghton Street, and everybody was together a great deal of the time, and that collective consciousness does seem to be much less now. In this building, obviously, the economists are all by themselves. We've got this bean counter thing we can eat here. We have kitchens on every floor, so it's genuinely the case that we have no reason to visit any other building in the school. So obviously you see other people much less. So I think that is quite a significant change. I think it's that LSE used to be thought to be a very centralised college that was. In particularly with, you know, the finances were all centralised and all that. Other colleagues from other universities experienced much more decentralisation. I think that's bound to come now. Not just because of the campus, but being a bigger college, it's just impossible to run everything centrally. And that may also influence this thing about the heads of department now being heads of department and not conveners. And new positions like departmental manager have sprung up. And I think there's masses more administrative staff here than there used to be.
You mentioned the senior common room before.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that people would meet there and have tea. And was this because people used to take much more regular tea breaks?
Yeah.
And people used to also take breaks at the same time, kind of almost?
Yeah, because that's when tea was served. It was as much as do it yourself, you know, the academics wouldn't know how to make a cup of tea in those days, so they would be dependent on somebody serving it. I mean, that's not true, but they have no way of boiling a kettle because there would be no water. or at least, you know, it would need quite a bit of ingenuity to do a bit of self-catering, whereas now we have these kitchens.
So people would convene there different times in the day to have a hot drink because they couldn't make hot drinks in their offices because they didn't have any access to kettles or...
Yeah, that sort of thing, yeah. So tea would be served at 4 o'clock and everybody would troop up there because that's the only way they could get a cup of tea. that sounds pretty pathetic. But
you see photographs of LSE, black and white photographs,
yes,
from that period of people just sitting around having tea.
Yeah, that's right.
Or in the short library as well.
Yes. Yes, it's nice to think. Yeah. I think the level of aspiration of the school has been increased enormously in terms of facilities and the like. If you go back, if you like, the new, you know, new academic building is really quite splendid, and I guess this new thing that they have, a new centre buildings, look, you know, pretty stylish, the student centre. I don't know, I mean, it was wonderful from the outside. I'll make sense of it inside. It seems to be all concrete and brickwork and like. But from the outside, yeah. So I think, yeah, basically there is a serious attempt to sort of move away from sort of romantic shabbiness in favour of something that's more sort of commercial in terms of buildings and facilities, and that sort of spills over. I think we don't, in the old days to some extent we used to have a, you know, things are dreadful but what can you expect sort of attitude towards facilities here, and that is I think now changed. Yeah, so I think the, and yet we're generating all these vast amounts of money, like vast, you know, the LSE has got vastly more. Adrian Hoare once told me he was at a meeting of heads of administration of all the universities, and the person put up a chart of the current bank balances or financial balances of each of the universities and asked, without their names on, and asked the assembled chief administrators to say which they were. And his was easy because he had this vast circle. Everybody else had practically nothing. So why is that? So, you know, that's because we happen to have got into the situation having a lot of overseas students at a time when overseas student fees were free, it could be set wherever you liked, and home student fees were tightly controlled. But we certainly haven't spent it, and... even the breaking of the current breaking of academic salaries, which is another thing, another aspirational matter that, which Craig has been much more focused on than was Howard, paying masses of money to academics. But even so, that was prompted not by the fact we got all this money, but by the fact that University College was and others were taking the lead in forcing up academic salaries. Yeah, so we're not. We you know, we don't want to, we're not, I don't know. I think to some extent, the attitude still is, you know, we are, as I was saying with the rhinoceros, we plow on doing what we think we ought to be doing, and, rather than to try, you know, making a bit, rather than sort of spending our money very ostentatiously on things other than the student centre, which was itself specially endowed with. I think most of the money came from Saw Sweet Hock or whatever he's called. At least £1 million.
I'm not sure
pounds.
What his full name is, but yeah.
Sauce.
There must be something with sauce in it somewhere.
Yeah. I think so. No, myself, it's funny. You know, obviously, I'm sure everybody said that, you know, a lot of things that happen seem very important at the time, but afterwards you can't really quite remember what the fuss was all about. But yeah, so there's nothing outstanding that I can think.